Hey everyone, welcome to Time Sensitive. This week, Spencer's in conversation with the artist Hank Willis Thomas, known for his multidisciplinary work that confronts issues of racism, polarization, and violence head on. Among his current projects is a memorial on Boston Common to Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, created with Mass Design Group. What'd you guys talk about?
So we get into his constant reconsidering of photographic messages within words, symbols, advertising, kind of how he thinks about all the time he spent archiving, looking at, and decoding these messages. Hank's actually never publicly really talked about time in the context of his work, so it's really interesting to go deep into the philosophies around that, how he thinks about, you know, frozen time in an image. And we get into his figuration meets abstraction approach to memorialization, which of course connects to the new Dr. King and Coretta Scott King Memorial in the Boston Common. We also talked about the influence of his mom, Deborah Willis, who's a photographer, author, and art historian who taught him so much about photography and art making. And really, there's this symbiotic relationship they have between their creative practices. We discussed his early work exploring the language of advertising and the racism embedded in it as well. And we, of course, got into his Four Freedoms Super PAC project and its ongoing work around truth, politics, and justice, particularly a new project they're building around the news media. They're basically creating their own news channel. And this gets into the intersection of what it means to be a journalist and a reporter or a member of the press in this post-truth age.
I'm very excited to hear this episode. But before we get into it, we'd first like to thank our season six sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. Through its courses, talks, exhibitions, and publications, as well as its extensive research program, Le Cole sits at the intersection of art, gemology, and craftsmanship. Founded in 2012, it explores and showcases jewelry in all aspects, contributing to and consolidating knowledge around the world of jewelry.
From prehistoric to contemporary jewelry, from men's jewelry to tribal designs, from rare gems to goldsmithing techniques, Le Cole covers a wide range of topics and approaches. Making jewelry knowledge more accessible to all, Le Cole allows the public to learn about things such as the no longer existing jewelry house Le Cloche, 20th century female jewelers, and the impeccable work of the artist, jewelry maker, and metalsmith Daniel Brush.
Opening up a territory that has long remained largely unknown and compartmentalized, the jewelry arts, Le Cole brings an incredible level of knowledge and rigor to all that it does. It even has a scientific council made up of experts in the realms of academia, museums, and science. This group helps ensure that its various programs, exhibitions, and projects have a consistently high level of quality. You can find out more about Le Cole at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now, here's Spencer and Hank.
Hi, Hank. Welcome to Time Sensitive.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
So, you're someone who spends a lot of time thinking about words, symbols, advertising, images. Looking at and processing archives of photography and consumer culture has largely been what we might say is your life's work. And so I wanted to start there. It's a broad question, but how do you think about your time spent reconsidering photographic messages?
How do I think about it?
Yeah, the time spent.
Well, so this is a time-sensitive question. Well, the way you ask it makes me feel like I'm wasting my time. I definitely appreciate the power of now. And funny that you asked that, because as a photographer, it's all about capturing the moment and being in the moment completely so you can capture the moment. And as a photo conceptual artist, I'm usually referencing the past, thinking about the future. So the now rarely plays a role in the work that I do. And I'd never really thought about that until you asked this time-sensitive question.
Well, has this work reshaped how you think about time more generally? Like, what role does time play in your work, and how do you think about it philosophically?
Well, I got into photography not only because my mother, Deborah Willis, is a photographer and art historian and a photo historian, but because I loved the process of capturing time and putting split seconds of time in a window of art was really exciting to me. And then the processing, everything when you're like capturing the film and then you're processing the negatives was all about time. And then you print the photograph and it was all about time. In the digital age, literally you can take a photo and print it almost instantly. Time has become, especially in this post-COVID moment, very elastic. When I think about 2020, it seems like that was 10 years or 5 years in 1 year. And I think about 2022, it feels like 3 months. So I am, from a personal perspective, really excited about presencing the very moment that I'm in with you now. I'm also thinking about the people in the future who are listening to this now or then. And my work, especially on the cusp of putting a monument in Boston Common,
we'll get to that,
is timeless.
I was hoping you might speak here to a specific piece, Remember Me, which was recently on view at the Parrish Art Museum, in terms of finding the source material, thinking about how to use and incorporate that source material, and basically talk about that piece from the perspective of time.
Sure. Well, I was in a show in 2009 that was a collaboration between myself and another artist named Willie Cole at the Amistad Collection at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. And Willie and I were tasked to go through the archive and dig deeper. And so we spent a lot of time up at the museum, in the stacks, in the archives. And I was fascinated with all of these postcards. They had this amazing postcard collection of a lot of caricature, racist postcards. And then mixed in were some kind of very kind of the moment, like contemporary of that moment, 19th century and early 20th century postcards that were colloquial, like people were quotidian, I guess. People were just writing postcards to the loved ones and sending them. And I think about postcards as 19th century and early 20th century email. And they were the first generation of people who could have a image or
DMs.
Text, yeah, and like send it far away and someone would get it, which was like pretty nuts. And for people who were either the generation of slavery or one generation removed, to be able to take a photograph of yourself and send it to your loved ones was huge. And so looking at African American vernacular photography, as my mother has done, I recognize that the Black experience is not what we read about in newspapers or in history books or in popular culture. And in fact, it is a human experience. That there is no specific Black experience. There are people of all kinds of ethnicities who leave their families, who have been ostracized and leave their family, leave their home or leave their family because of systematic oppression, and also still want, as an attempt to be seen as human beings. And photography has been a landscape where a lot of people have been dehumanized, and also people have chosen to claim their humanity. And so how I think about time is related to that is, as you can I'm one of the postcards I found, I should say, said it was a postcard of a presumably African-American man with a World War I cavalry hat on, standing in front of a barn and a farm with a rifle, denim jeans, and a white button-up coat, which looks like his Sunday's best. Just looking at that postcard, I'm like, okay, a Black man from 100 years ago with a gun, you know, who clearly signifying that he was a soldier. And then I turned it over, and all that was written was, "Remember me." And that was like, whoa. Because he, in that instance, whoever wrote that, transcended space and time. They brought me back to their moment. They brought them into the future.
And it becomes this neon sculpture at the parish.
Yeah. And so 10 years after I find it, or 12, 13 years after I find it, I did make a neon, like 5 years of that handwritten text. It was so beautiful. But in the parish, and also in work that I finally got around to making, I actually used that image with the retroreflective technology that I've developed in photographic printing and that handwriting in that way. But now also many people who are going up and down 27 will be seeing at nighttime and daytime that person's handwriting. And for all we know, because this was found in Hartford, Connecticut, and we know that there was a long tradition of Black farmers in Eastern Long Island, it could be where this person was standing when they took the picture, which is really nuts.
Memory and remembering in many ways are the core of your work. And I was hoping, you know, maybe could you speak to the relationships between slowness and memory and between speed and forgetting, and how this distinction connects in your art making? Because I think it's very visible there.
Well, when I think about digital photography, that's where I'm mostly connected to speed and forgetting. What I loved about analog photography is that I did have to remember so much to take a picture, and I did have to remember so much in the process of making the print. And the memories I have of making that work are very different than a picture I took and then maybe I did some Photoshop work on and then put out into the world, because there isn't this, and I'm not romanticizing it. It's just, there was a muscle memory in the making of pictures before, where now it's like, you give me a digital camera, I'm just going to take like 1,000 pictures and then maybe I'll edit them. Maybe someone else will edit them and it'll be like, okay, that one sounds good, but I'm not as careful as, you know, some other photographers are about like the finest detail of every picture, because I feel like their pictures are forgettable in a way that they weren't before. I remember the photo of the year, and we now consume tens of thousands of photographs every day. So how does one stick out? And if it does, it's usually a meme. It's not like
a GIF or a,
yeah.
Memorialization, or the idea of it anyway, and the relationship between art and civic life runs through your work, if not all of your work, most of your work. And soon you're going to unveil with one of your collaborators, Mass Design Group, the Embrace, which you were alluding to earlier, this 20-foot-high circular bronze monument in the Boston Common that honors Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his wife, Coretta Scott King. Tell me more generally about your approach to the notion of memorializing something and how that comes to light in this King project.
My approach to memorializing things really does start with the work of my mother, Deborah Willis, who I mentioned earlier. Her first book was called Black Photographers, 1840 to 1940, a biobibliography. And what's critical when you just think about the title, Black Photographers in 1840.
Astounding.
Which is, what does that even mean? You know, when we're told that at that time, everybody who was Black was illiterate and everyone who was Black was a slave or disenfranchised. And it's not to say that these people were literate or not disenfranchised, but it is to say that their lives were clearly more complicated. Because to be able to make a photograph in 1940, or 1939, as Augustus Washington, one of the photographers she highlights, did, is like, you had to know, you had to understand physics and chemistry and mechanics.
It's a science experiment.
You had to have the means to get or build a camera and build glass plate negatives or whatever that would be able to make a lasting image. And then you had to have the curiosity to go about looking at the world in this contemplative way that photographers do. And then you had to have the confidence that you were the one worth doing it so that your name is still attached to that image. And so when I think about memorial, I think about how people 150 years from now might consider what I'm doing and what I'm a part of. And so the embrace, which is a monument to love, is as much about love of all human beings as it is about Dr. King and Mrs. King, because 150 years from now, if human beings are still alive, there probably won't be any internet. There probably won't be any form of of knowledge about this post-apocalyptic time. But seeing this embrace, these arms embracing, that will be something that they can still connect to and translate. And most of what we know about past societies and civilizations is what was remained or retained in the art. Like, we don't always understand how the languages were spoken or who was important or what was important, but we can actually look at the art and get some form of sensibility that we can relate to. So my memorials are for those people.
Yeah, another memorial of yours, at least how I view it, is Raise Up. It's this sculpture, 10 heads and 20 raised arms at Mass Design Group's National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. It's also existed as smaller sculptural works elsewhere. Could you speak to the particular approach to conceiving that piece, and do you view it as a memorial?
Sure. Well, Brian Stevenson, a civil rights lawyer who is from Alabama, who recognized that in order for us to really address the atrocities of slavery and lynching and also even mass incarceration, we needed to have a locus. And so he invited me to consider with him what to do that, to make a memorial to those, in this case, people who were lynched. And talking to me, he talked to Mass Design, Michael Murphy specifically from Mass Design, and other people. And Mass came up with a really brilliant concept in collaboration with him, which what ultimately became the memorial site that we see in Montgomery now. And what was going to be my brilliant idea wound up being a part of the larger memorial, which is a huge honor. And the work Raise Up that's in it is about submission and surrender, but it's also about faith and humanity overall. And I am often asking myself and others to be aware of the multiple readings that we can have on history and on a specific moment. That comes from my experience being a photographer, where I could be standing right next to someone and their picture may not be any more true than mine, but it may be more seductive. And realizing that 10 people can be taking a picture or looking at the very same thing and have a very different truth emerge because of the seductiveness of the image.
I think what's also interesting here is this merging of the figurative and the abstract, and that there's enough figuration to allow you to imagine what's being depicted, but there's so much abstraction within it that it allows for a multitude of interpretations.
Mm-hmm. You're giving me all kinds of images now.
Another memorial you've worked on also with Mass Design Group is the Gun Violence Memorial Project, done in partnership with the prevention organizations Purpose Over Pain and Every Town for Gun Safety. This debuted in 2019 at the Chicago Architecture Biennial and most recently was on view at the National Design Museum in D.C. It comprises a series of houses, each made with 700 glass bricks, this reference to the number of people in the U.S. killed by guns every week. When Michael Murphy was on the podcast, he told me a little bit about how this project came to fruition, but I thought it'd be meaningful for you here to share your own personal connection and reason for feeling so tied to the project and so why it's so personal for you.
Yeah, well, I did, from my recollection, and Murphy's might be different, but we were walking up to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, and he had just been speaking to Everytown and Purpose Over Pain and other people around the impact of that monument. And I mentioned that I'd always wanted to do a monument for victims of gun violence because I went to high school in D.C. I grew up in New York, but I went to high school in D.C. and was surrounded by memorials everywhere. There's a memorial for, there's a World War II memorial, there's a Vietnam memorial, there's a Lincoln Memorial, you know, there's all kinds
MLK
of memorials.
Memorial.
Now there's an MLK Memorial, there's a Jefferson Memorial, et cetera. But there are more people shot and killed every year in the United States than have died in the past two dominant American wars. And to think that in some parts of this country, you are less safe than those in a war zone is pretty insane. And that there will be justified memorials to the soldiers who dedicated their lives and lost their lives to these wars. There is no place to memorialize people like my cousin, Sunga Thomas Willis, who was murdered on February 2nd, 2000. And then the nearly 500,000 people who were shot and killed since he died, which is just kind of crazy to think that, you know, we have, if not a pandemic, an epidemic in our country, that we're unwilling, much like lynching, to make a space to really come to terms with. And so I have made my own memorials where I've been using flags, well, making flags that are thousands of stars representing the number of people who were shot and killed by others in each year, and draping these kind of all-star flags across the ground. But I was excited about the idea that we came to with Mass around the artifacts, because my cousin Sunga, I still have some of his clothes. And when I'm gone, who will be able to tell the difference? And I thought that it would be really important to memorialize some essence of him through putting an artifact in a memorial like this. And so I am really just excited to be a part of that memorial, which is really just a prototype for what hopefully will either become an obsolete idea or a really important memorial in the future.
And extending out of this work, I did want to bring up one last public work of yours, Unity, this 22-foot bronze arm with an upward pointing index finger. It's at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. Do you view that as a memorial? And how does that connect?
Well, Unity, again, is something that someone 100 years from now or 1,000 or 500 years from now will see, and they will have their own phenomenological relationship to it, just like someone today. There is another symbolic message to have a 22-foot bronze arm pointing to the sky in this moment, because bronze is typically not used to represent across our country people of African descent whose skin is bronze. And for this work, I did 3D scan the arm of Joel Embiid, who's got a rather large bronze arm. He's the center for the Philadelphia 76ers and an African immigrant. And that sculpture was inspired by a photograph I found in 1987 or 86 of Meadowlark Lemon of the Harlem Globetrotter spinning a basketball on his finger in front of the Statue of Liberty. And I recognized the connection between upward mobility and social mobility through sports and the mobility of immigrants from foreign places to the United States. And I thought that Joel and his story is a powerful kind of connection between those things. And then the simplicity that an arm pointing to the sky could just be an arm pointing to the sky. It could be symbolizing unity. It could be saying we're number one. When I put it up, reputable news agencies asked me if it was an ISIS symbol. So art is open to interpretation.
Wow. Let's go back to your youth. And I want to start here with Roy de Carava's 1983 exhibition, The Sound I Saw, which was at the Studio Museum. You've described that show as major for you and that you see it as what you've called a head trip. What about de Carava's work do you find so moving? And are there any particular images from that exhibition that stick with you in your mind today?
Well, first, I saw the show at the Studio Museum as a child and didn't really connect to it. But the catalog from that show was on either my coffee table or something in a house. Like it was one of the most prevalent books in my childhood. But when I saw his retrospective at MoMA when I was in college, I had a very different relationship to the work. What I saw in that book with photographs of John Coltrane and various other luminaries was an artist painting with light. And where we are conditioned or trained as photographers to capture an image, freeze it, and make as much visible as possible, Roy de Carava was really digging into the darkness. And so he would use elements and highlights of light as the whole form of the photograph. And so the book being titled The Sound I Saw was a head trip for me, even as a kid, because I was like, how do you see sound? And as a photographer who's really invested in translating experience through his medium, Roy de Carava did that with motion and light. I recognize that photography is clearly an art form when a person can make such poetic and profound and deep and sometimes abstract images through their approach to representing their experience.
So your mother, as you mentioned, is a photographer and art historian. She's written like 30-some books. She teaches at NYU. Your father's a jazz musician, film producer, was a member of the Black Panthers. You and your mom have spoken a bit about your symbiotic relationship in this great TED Talk. And you grew up in this house full of not just great books on photography, but great photographs. How would you describe this environment? And in retrospect, and yes, this is probably a pretty obvious but vital question, what impact do you think your parents had on you becoming a photographer and artist?
Well, my father was born in the segregated South. My mom was born in a version of the segregated North in Philadelphia. But they both were the first generation of African Americans to get a crack at freedom. You know, and I use crack because I'm referencing Jackie Robinson, who with the cracking of that baseball bat in 1955 when the Brooklyn Dodgers won the World Series. But that sound of his iconic home run really did open the door for generations of African Americans who were coming up to go out into the world in ways that their parents never could have imagined. So my father lived in Europe, and I mean, he was drafted into the war because of racist draft policies, blah, blah, blah. But he lived in Europe, and he studied at Columbia and, got a PhD in physics and traveled the world doing art and real estate and whatever else he wanted and did. And my mother, who did go to junior college for typing, decided that at some point she could and should be a photographer and went to graduate school for photography and, again, traveled the world doing what she loved. And growing up with two parents who followed their dreams, I don't think I had much choice as to whether or not I could or should. I was not really interested in art per se because all my mom's friends were broke. Many of them now do have MacArthur's, and I don't know how rich they are, but they're not broke. Many of them are. But I also realized that you don't go into making art to make money. You go into art to make an impact on yourself first and then on the audience that interacts with the work, and that there is no greater reward than feeling transformed by something that you're a part of making.
Hey everyone, taking a quick break here to tell you a little bit about our season 6 sponsor, L'Ecole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison, Van Cleef, and Arpels. In addition to exhibitions, publications, research projects, and public events, L'Ecole offers a range of courses led by experts across jewelry, craft, history, and the arts. Celebrating its first decade this year, L'Ecole, which has permanent campuses in both Paris and Hong Kong, plans to open a third space in Shanghai next year, and will soon open another in Paris, which will feature a public library of more than 7,000 reference works on jewelry and gems. At its main Paris space, L'Ecole is also opening a gemotech, or gem library, that contains some 1,200 stones for visitors to view and even handle. This year, they'll also be presenting 6 exhibitions in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Paris, and publishing 8 books. You can learn more about L'Ecole and its current and upcoming offerings at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now, back to the episode. I want to touch briefly on your education. In high school, you left to Episcopal, this boarding school in Alexandria, Virginia, for a year, then attended Duke Ellington School of the Arts in D.C., as you mentioned, which had a museum studies program. Then you go on to NYU Tisch.
Before my mom was there.
Spent 4 years there, then on to California College of the Arts for your MFA, first in photography, then for a second master's in visual and critical studies. You studied with Jim Goldberg, Chris Johnson, Larry Sultan, and from what I understand, CCA and the Bay Area at the time, this is the early 2000s, was sort of a training ground for collectivist thinking. I mean, it's long been that, but particularly around art making, the sort of collective art groups, and that's something that's become really central to your work today. And so I wanted to ask, how do you think now about this path from Episcopal to CCA? And what did your time at CCA in particular do in terms of shaping this collectivist artist approach?
Sure. Well, first, I do want to start. I mean, I went to elementary and junior high school in New York City, didn't get into any of the fancy public schools or private schools. But my cousin, Sunga, who I mentioned, was going to this private boarding school. He was an athlete in D.C. And I got in because I was his cousin, and they just assumed, because of either racism or a sleight of hand, that I would be talented in sports and academics the way that he was. I was not in either. And so that's the main reason that I only went there for a year. But I also got to go from being a pretty multi-ethnic environment in New York to a place where it was like 300 students, all boys. Maybe there were like 20 Asian international students, 2 Latinx people. They were also international. In 18 black students, mostly African Americans. And so I went from being kind of one of many in New York to being part of a super minority in Virginia, And so this case, Confederate flags were in dorm rooms, and statues to Confederate soldiers were things that people had in their rooms or on their desks, that they talked about the pride of the South. And that was like a whole learning for me, you know, around the complexities of American patriotism. And then going from there to Duke Ellington School for the Arts, which is even named after a African-American transcendent artist, where that case was almost exact opposite, where I became part of a super majority. And there were like 30 white students and 400 African-Americans and 5 Latinx and 5 Asian students, and got to see, so experiencing the racism from the super majority to being part of a super minority that was not as sensitive as some might think to other ethnicities was really profound, because I had to figure out, who am I? So I'm a New Yorker, and then I find myself in DC, and then in Virginia, then I'm in DC. And so these critical moments in my youth, like 14, 15, 16, each year, I had to almost reimagine myself.
Yeah. And from what I read at Tisch, you were, during your 4 years there, the only Black student in the photography program.
Only Black male. Yes. So then, yes, I went to NYU, and there was that experience in Tisch. And so then, yeah, I kind of felt the burden of like representing Black male identity in school, which was kind of a heavy burden for like an 18-year-old. And then in graduate school, so after I graduated undergrad, where I studied photography and Africana studies, not knowing I was really following my mom's footsteps. But then I did work as a photographer's assistant and a production assistant and coordinator, et cetera, on film and commercial shoots. But I interned at the Chris Rock Show. I was on the Saturday Night Live film unit, which were both social commentary media. It wasn't typical. And there were commercials, Victoria's Secret and others that I worked on. But being part of film sets that were looking at popular culture and critiquing it was really educational to me. And so when I went to grad school and I was studying with Larry Sultan, who was both being a commercial photographer, I think my first year he shot the first Jordan campaign for Jumpman. And I was, it was right after Sunga was murdered. But Larry had also in his practice collaborated with Mike Mendel on doing nearly 100 billboards where they were what we now call culture jamming, where they were like making critiques of consumerism in often co-opted billboards that they were doing. But it was very much about collaboration. And I like to say I got to the Bay Area right after it was fun, because the first dot-com boom in the late 90s kind of killed all the true creative energy in the Bay Area. But when I got there, it was a dot-com bust. So there was still some residue. They hadn't kicked everybody out like they have now. But there was still residue of like the kind of carefree, creative, collaborative, summer of love kind of art making energy. And yeah, artists like Jim Goldberg and Todd Heido and Chris Johnson were like very much critical to my education. And Suzanne Lacy, who had created the Center for Art and Public Life, had introduced me to this idea of social practice and like making art that has a social impact. So I kind of took all that together and had started collaborating with other artists almost from the beginning, but primarily in 2006 with a public art video called Along the Way.
Well, the Sultan connection with the Jordan campaign is kind of interesting, given so much of your early work was really focused on the language of advertising. Series such as Branded, Unbranded, Rebranded. Could you share a little bit about what you learned about American society and culture and its history of racism through this work? Because, I mean, you have a piece from this series, Absolute Power, a rendering of this Absolute Vodka ad that really speaks to this, I think, that kind of retranslates, represents so much of the visual language that we've been served over the past few decades.
Sure. Well, my jobs in undergrad and grad school, two of the jobs that had a huge influence on me were working in the library, in the photo library at Tisch, and then the art library at CCA. And when you're working in the library, you look at a lot of books. And you also look at a lot of magazines. And I became pretty versed in the landscape, the visual culture landscape. And I was really fascinated with something that it crystallized for me in my mom's work, is that if we know that some young woman from North Philadelphia, out of her curiosity, can find images and tell stories about the American experience that really counter what a lot of what we've been told, what is the value of what's being told? And then I realized that there is a grand narrative, a master narrative. I think Public Enemy says, you know, real history isn't history, it's his story. And typically, it is his story that's being told, and he is usually the victor. In our society, he is usually an Anglo-Saxon descended wealthy person. And so his story is not our story. And I became interested in our story because when I looked through all of these books and all these images, I recognized that there is a much more complicated story being told, but we seem to only primatize one. And so I started to think about, like, how can I insert myself and other voices into his story? And so I looked at advertising and realized that most people who were making advertisements were, you know, if you watch the show Mad Men, upper middle class and white men. And his story to his wife about what she should care about really served him. And his story to the person who cleaned his house was serving him. And so I was interested in what was her story and what was the other his story and how could those combine. And so I realized that advertising is the most powerful language in the world because you don't necessarily have to speak the language to be able to decode it, because we've all become media literate and therefore conditioned to read images, to perceive things that are definitely not there objectively. And so I started to realize, well, how can I use that language of advertising and talk about things that advertising couldn't responsibly talk about, like slavery, like gender issues? So the branded and unbranded series were really looking at advertising as a tool for communicating ideas. And I like to point out that race is the most successful advertising campaign of all time. And whoever created it probably had a vested interest in making themselves better than others. And if only because of the absurdity of the term Caucasian, because most people who are defined Caucasian
aren't from the Caucasus.
And so, like, already we're starting off, we're starting off crazy, you know. And to say that there's like a billion people in the continent of Africa, but they're all basically the same, you know, and then even the concept of Europe being a continent. What did you learn a continent was when you were in elementary school?
It was just like a landmass. I don't know.
I learned it was a landmass that was surrounded by water on all sides. Like, Europe is just like a tiny part of Asia. But the myth, because the Europeans telling the story did not want to acknowledge.
This makes me think there's this great work you did and its name is escaping me.
Africa, America? A Place to Call Home?
Place to Call Home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's this great work you did, A Place to Call Home, where you merged two continents. Could you talk about that here?
Yeah, well, so that's part of what I realized is like, okay, where I'm, when I call myself African American, where is that? Where is Africa, America? It's clearly a figment of my imagination. And so I made a work where I merged the continent of Africa and the continent of North America to make a place that I could call home, because I've been all over the continent of Africa, I've been all over North America, and I haven't felt quote unquote home in any place. And so that's because it is my imagination. And that's what I'm saying, that like our identities are all a figment of our imagination. And we use these myths as a way to codify and to brutalize and romanticize others and ourselves.
Another component of your work, I wanted to get into this, is the participatory nature of it. And particularly through Question Bridge and Truth Booth, in many ways, these are time-based works. They're collective works. Could you share a bit about these two projects and how did they develop? What did you learn through creating them?
One of the reasons I also love collaborating with other people is that my ego is forced to find a comfortable space in a larger thing. You know, as an artist, as an independent artist, I'm focusing on what I care about and what I think is important. But when I invite someone to collaborate with me, it's what do we think and how do we feel about things? And the more different that their biography is than mine, the more complicated, the more we both get to stretch as a way to come together around something, which means that the audience also has some form of a stretch. And so Question Bridge Black Males was a video mediated megalogue between African-American men, self-identified African-American men, and my collaborators, three of whom are African-American men, two of whom were not. We recorded 150 self-identified African-American men asking questions of other self-identified African-American men. And the goal of the project was to show that there was as much diversity within any demographic as there was outside of it. But our premise was faulty from the beginning because we thought we would ask one, we take that question that one African-American man asked and then take it to another African-American and then get the best answer and then use that to make a piece. But what happened is we took that one question to 10 different people and we got 10 different answers. There was no better answer because even though there were 10 different black men, they were really just 10 different human beings responding to a question in 10 different ways, which means that there are probably 30 million different ways of answering that specific question. I realize that that is the very truth, that the imaginary lines that we place around our identity, that Question Bridge Black Males wasn't just about black men, it was about people. What happens when people are put into groups, how they relate to the notion of the group itself and other people within the group, and all how they find agency, knowing all of the constraints of being marginalized in a group, that challenges the notion of the truth. And so the Truth Booth, which followed that, was a modern day confession booth where we invited thousands of people to go into this inflatable speech bubble and respond to the prompt, a video prompt, "The truth is." And so they would come in and they record themselves saying, "The truth is," and they would just go from there. And many times, much like with Question Bridge, where the viewer, in this case me, would see a person read them and be like, okay, I know what kind of question they're going to ask, or I know what kind of truth they're going to talk about, or the way they start, it's like, oh, they're talking about this. And then it goes left. And all of a sudden, all of my prejudices called into question, and recognizing that my truth and their truth can exist and both be true, even if they appear to contradict itself. And that's the nature of being human beings. Like, I'm looking at you, you're looking at me. My truth looks very different than your truth. Yeah. And the more that we can acknowledge that our lived experience is about a multitude of truths in harmony or in conflict existing, the more we can be conscious about how we navigate that reality.
There's a sort of artist as reporter quality to this work too. And I did want to ask you, you know, how do you view the connection between art making and journalism or reportage? Like, do you in some ways view yourself as a reporter?
Well, Four Freedoms, which is my most prominent current collaboration, is currently embarking on a new venture, which you're welcome to work on it with us, called Four Freedoms News. We have operated over the past 8 years as artists, as quote, political operative in an anti-partisan platform that we created. And now we realized, in part because watching the news, that nobody knows what the news is. So why don't we be the news? And so we are now operating or performing as journalists, because the legitimacy of being called the news is something that we believe is creative. Like journalism, again, is rooted in a very, well, we cannot detach the forms of journalism that we now have from the history of imperialism and colonialism. If you learn about popular journalism going back at least until the mid, well, we can talk about the pamphlets and as a form of journalism in the 18th and 19th century, which were both a combination of propaganda and the news, which morphed into different news forms. But thinking about people like Henry Morton Stanley, who became famous for his exploits into Africa, where he found, you know, his famous statement, Mr. Livingston, I presume, where people learned about through the New York Times and the Herald about Africa through these salacious stories that this journalist would write, right? And
Africa in quotes, journalists in quotes.
It was the dark continent.
Yeah.
And you can't detach that history from what's happening now. Like the reason that I believe Donald Trump became president was because he understood that the news was just what you could get people to talk about. You know, so like he could say Mexico's sending rapists, and they're like, and then the news would say he is opposed to immigration, which is not what he said. He said Mexico's sending rapists. And all of a sudden, this issue that was maybe an issue that was relevant is now the central issue. And then he, you know, could just say, okay, we're going to ban Muslims. And then that becomes a thing. And this reality that
China virus.
Yeah, the China virus. But like, whereas like, because he saw what happened in 2003 with Iraq and was super critical of it, that the news was interested in shock and awe and weapons of mass destruction.
I mean, even the sounds they make when they're like cutting between news broadcasts.
Well, that's the other thing. If you now look at CNN, a lot of times it'll be like, so-and-so slams so-and-so, or even NPR, so-and-so rips so-and-so. And I'm like, is this the WWE? that's what we're calling journalism, because it's always been a revenue-based model.
I just saw a tech publication write about SBF as like a contagion. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, this is insane.
Yeah. The more that you can get anxiety and fear and kind of...
Well, I think it can't be understated the importance also of having Columbia Journalism School's first black dean, Jelani Cobb, at the helm at this crucial, critical moment in how we define truth, how we think about journalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really important.
Right. And he was not seen as a central voice 10 years ago. Right. And that tells you how elusive and elastic the medium of journalism is. And so why an artist are, we specialize it. What I like to say is good art asks questions and good design answers them. And the quality of the questions dictates the quality of the answers. And if you don't have people asking good questions in the form of art making, then how can you have great answers? And so that's why I do see myself as a journalist, and I see myself as a historian. I see myself as a political figure. I also just see myself as a mass of organisms that are just like struggling to survive and maybe using ego as a means to feed its dinner of nutrition.
Before we finish, I want to continue just briefly on Four Freedoms, which started as this first artist-run super PAC. You co-founded it. We just got through the 2022 midterm elections, in which this widely anticipated or reported red wave didn't happen. And I was wondering, how are you feeling about the election? And what are your thoughts looking toward 2024?
I got to go back to Public Enemy. Don't believe the hype. Be the hype. We were not the first artist-run super PAC. We just said we were. And then somebody, a journalist, wrote about it. Then another journalist fact-checked that. And guess what? We were the first artist-run super PAC. And that's how I view the news, right? So when the news is like, first it's like, oh, well, the Republicans aren't going to do particularly well this midterms. Then it's like, there's going to be a massive red wave. And then, oh my God, who's going to make it? Is this going to be the person? Is this going to be the person? Let's give a lot of, we know that giving airtime definitely gives people credibility. So why don't we just give Herschel Walker a lot of airtime? Oh my God, the news is getting close. The race is getting close. Oh my gosh, what is going to happen? It's like, okay. I mean, I understand. It's entertainment. You know, we can be cynical about the fact that like somebody are making billions of dollars off of keeping us engaged in the quote unquote news. Or we can say these are narratives that we can actually claim for ourselves, and that like, do the Democrats winning, is that going to save the day? I love my parents and Joe Biden seems like a relatively decent human being, but he's 80. And I'm not saying that somebody who's 20 or 40 has any more kind of power or awareness of what's happening now, but like if the fate of humanity lives in people who are looking at the other side of life, then that should say a lot about what's going on, you know, meaning that like, why are the most people most invested in the direction of humanity, the people who've been living the longest? And so I don't know, I'm really. And then also, like, if the Democrats, who tend to have the majority of people in the country in agreement with them, tend to have a slightly better grasp on the truth, tend to be more decent in their behavior and civil, are struggling to beat people who are, like, flying by the seat of their pants, lying, avowed, like, greedy, selfish people. Who are also self-righteous and hypocritical, like outwardly, not even like, you know, like secretively. They're like, I just said this yesterday. I know I didn't say that. Like, and often xenophobic and racist and sexist and homophobic, even if that includes themselves. Like, if they can't beat them, like, how are they going to affect global warming? like it should not be close. You know, like, hey, I'm a pathological liar. You have been doing this for 40 years and people think that you're a really honest, genuine person. Let's duke it out. And like the pathological liar almost wins.
Election deniers.
I mean, I love it because I realize that like it's all about storytelling. Like if I can tell a good story, then I can get people to do whatever I want. And that's as a creator who, again, I'm an artist, so I'm more of a, I can ask a lot of good questions, but you guys are storytellers. Also, I'd like to point out that lawmakers are designers. Like storytellers are designers, but lawmakers are also designers. Like the laws that are written for our society, that's social design. And the fact that they're devout, non-creative people designing our society, and we got very creative people like you sitting in rooms like this with very creative people like me talking shit while they're designing our society says that like, we are not doing what we're supposed to be doing. It's cozy. It's nice in here, but we should be in a dark room with no windows plotting on how we're going to like rule the world.
Well, I want to end this conversation on quilts.
Okay. Did I go overboard just then?
No, this will connect. Throughout your work, you've created a wide range of quilts, stitching together prison uniforms, sports team jerseys. Guernica from 2016 really comes to mind here. Incredible piece you did. And a quilt motif will even appear in the labyrinthian granite plaza beneath the King Memorial in Boston. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an obvious metaphor, but I did want to use it as a way to end, because when looking at your work as a whole, as a quilt, there's this kind of profound idea of referencing the past through selective materials. And it also gets us at this idea of the archive, how it's always present, that there's this constant presence of the past, kind of connects to Saadia Hartman's notion of temporal entanglement. How do you think about quilts and quilting in your work? And I guess perhaps metaphorically too, within the context of your career.
Well, I'm constantly weaving disparate things together. That's like stitching is most of what I do conceptually. And I really got into the making quilts through, my mother made quilts for a long time with my aunts, and my grandmother made quilts. And my mother made all these quilts of her father's ties after he died. And it was called Daddy's Ties. And she took, made photographs with those ties. That was really powerful because for her, my grandfather, every day he went to work, he put on a tie. And part of being a man in that moment was the way in which you carried yourself. You dressed like a man, not like us. But so these memories that were in this fabric for my mother about her father, and also the fact that this is a fabric that he wore around his neck for, you know, 30, 40 years.
It's a memorial.
Yeah, it's a memorial. It's a commemoration. It's, yeah, but it's, there's an intimacy in that. And so when I think about sports jerseys, where putting on something that has someone else's name on it, where I'm asking other people to recall moments of inspiration that this person had for me, or prison uniforms, where these are people who are anonymous and that their life and labor that's lived in these materials is seen as something that should be discarded. And like, what happens when those become material for representation of images or stories? It's sticky, it's complex, and it's, I guess that's what you call art.
Hank, thank you so much. It was really great, as always, to sit down with you.
Thanks so much. It's really fun to talk to you.
Extra thanks to our Season 6 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison, Van Cleef & Arpels. A unique place for learning, Le Cole welcomes the general public to the world of jewelry through courses, conferences, exhibitions, videos, and book publications. You can find out more about Le Cole at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen to our other podcasts, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. And if you like our programs, please be sure to subscribe and leave comments. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Ramon Broza, Emily Zhang, and Johnny Simon.